Hello, and welcome to Boss Madle, where I sit down and get real with some pretty amazing, creative women entrepreneurs. So grab yourself a cup of coffee or a glass of wine and get ready to be inspired. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the 17th episode of Boss Madle. Today, I sit down with Dr. Beth Ricconati, the author of the book Braided, A Journey of a Thousand Challahs. And in her book, Dr. Beth describes how, like most busy working moms, she was on that constant hamster wheel of life of doing and achieving and running around, and how the act of making challah really shifted her focus and her mindset, and how it really forced her to be in the present moment and to slow down. And Dr. Beth has essentially created a movement around making challah and is often joined by friends and family and neighbors at her home on Friday morning for this beautiful ritual. So speaking of community and ritual, I am sharing with you guys on Instagram a 30-day challenge that I will be starting, where I will try to add 1 to 2 activities to my morning routine. Something as simple as drinking an extra glass of water, or saying 3 things I'm grateful for, or reading 1 to 2 pages of an inspiring book. I think that sometimes these little micro changes can really create a shift in our focus and our energy and really, you know, imbue our day with positivity. So I invite you to join along. I'll include a list of little activities that you can choose from, and together we can kind of keep ourselves updated on our progress. And I think it'd be a really nice project to take along with us into the beginning of the school year when things start to, you know, get a little more busy. So I'll keep you posted on all of that. So without further ado, let me introduce Beth. Dr. Beth Ricconati is an award-winning author who has built her career around bringing wellness into women's everyday lives, especially moms juggling life and children. She practiced medicine at New York Presbyterian Columbia University Medical Center and the Cleveland Clinic, and now at the Venice Family Clinic. She lives in the Los Angeles area with her family and 1 challah-loving dog. Dr. Beth, welcome to the show. Hi, Dr. Beth. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
I am really excited because I devoured your book.
Oh, that makes me so happy.
Yes, and I'm a slow reader, but I loved your book, Braided, A Journey of a Thousand Challahs. And I was just curious, what made you decide to write this book? And what in particular about challah kind of spoke to you?
Oh, I love that question because there's so much here to unpack. I started making challah about 10 years ago when I was a completely stressed out mom and physician, and the kids were little. It was overwhelming. And a girlfriend said to me at the high holidays, you should make challah, which was rather laughable because I maybe made boxed brownies, but certainly challah was well above my pay grade. But I did it. Something about what she said that year really sparked, and I made the challah, and it was, at the risk of some hyperbole, transformative. It was incredible to stop and just be at the kitchen counter with 6 ingredients and a bowl for about a half an hour, my hands in that dough. It was incredible. I hadn't taken time for myself. And I was so overwhelmed, and it was such a great experience. And my kids and my husband were so excited about the output that I kept doing it. And before I knew it, I was rearranging my entire life to make challah on Fridays. And then about 5 years ago, I realized, I'm not the only stressed out mom on the block. If I've learned all these lessons making challah, maybe somebody else could benefit from this too. And that's when I thought, okay, I'm going to write a book about this. And Braided began.
Wow. And you write, what if the act of making that challah, the mixing, the kneading, the watching, and the waiting could heal your heartache and your sense of being overwhelmed? And I love that. And I think essentially you've started a movement, really.
I hope so. That would be my goal.
Yes. Why do you think we are so overwhelmed? I mean, my mom and many women in her generation said, we don't remember being like this, this frazzled, this kind of, this frenetic pace that women are expected to keep nowadays. What do you think is the cause?
Oh, I think it's probably multifactorial. And what I mean by that is that I think there are actually a lot of causes. I think it's a confluence of factors. One, we are doing a lot more out in the world, thank goodness, which is fantastic. But we're still also doing a lot at home. And then you add on top of that social media and how connected we are. And it becomes a lot very, very quickly. And it's hard to sort of untangle that. And it's really hard to take time for ourselves. You know, I'm so reminded when I travel and on an airplane and the stewardess of the flight attendant says, you know, please be sure to put your oxygen mask on yourself first before you put it on someone else. And for so long, I wasn't doing that. You know, I wasn't taking care of myself and I was running on empty. Making challah for me, it's like my oxygen mask. It's the moment to stop because we are all so busy. I mean, your mom is right.
Like, yeah.
It's a different time now.
Yeah. It's so true. Do you find that when you make the challah, it's almost like a form of meditation in the sense of, yes,
it's the moment. Yeah. It is my meditation. It is my moment to just be there. And it's not just even being there. It's, you know, if you've made bread yourself or, you know, done any kind of cooking where you're kneading the dough, that's meditation right there. That repetitive behavior. It's fantastic.
Yes.
When you add in the fact that it's tactile, you know, I'm using my hands. I don't use a bread machine. I make the dough from scratch with my hands. And like knitting or pottery or gardening, when you do things with your hands, there's actually a lot of research that shows this is fantastic for things like anxiety. It's just getting in there with your hands is a great way to really not only reconnect, but also mentally reconnect.
Yes, I think especially with social media and with us being online a lot, some of the basic activities that we used to do, writing a handwritten thank you note, meeting someone for coffee and hugging them, we lose that. So I love what you're saying about the idea of using your hands and having that as a form of comfort and, you know, there's some type of meditative quality to that that's really important.
Yeah. Yes.
So can you take us back a little bit and tell us how you got into medicine and, you know, what was the process like for you?
Well, I came at it in a very non-traditional way. I studied art history actually in college, but I had always been involved in ways of helping other people. You know, when I was 8, I became obsessed with the story of Helen Keller and her teacher, and I had to learn Braille. And then in middle school, when we had to write our first paper, that big, you know, probably 3-page paper, I don't know, so something little, but in hindsight, it seemed like monumental. I chose a medical topic. And I found myself in high school always working in the summer and volunteering in hospitals. So even though I took this, when I was actually in school, I was not doing the math and science and I was studying art, I, on the side, was always doing things that were related to health and well-being. And then I realized toward the end of college that I could actually bring all this together in an interesting way and do that by going to medical school. And by the way, I think art history is a fabulous major for going into medical school because you learn how to see, you learn how to look.
I was going to say, you're right that. You're right. Studying art taught me to see things nobody else saw, and it helped me save women's lives. And you also write, once I became a physician, I understood that to successfully practice medicine, I need to approach it as an art, not just as a science.
Right. Yeah. I don't think there's a one way. There's really a lot of nuance in medicine.
What did it teach you to see in a broader sense when you do see your patients? How did that art background come in handy?
Well, if you can imagine art history, there I am for 4 years looking in often in a dark classroom at slides on the screen. And we're looking and decoding so many other things by looking at that painting or sculpture or building or, you know, what have you, and learning how to break it apart. So when a patient then walks into my room, into the clinic, exam room, thank you. I was like, what's the word? I'm not just saying, oh, it's another patient. I'm really looking at them to see, well, how did they walk in? How are they carrying themselves? What are they wearing? Are they favoring this part of their body or that part of their body? How are they sitting? All of the these subtleties that actually tell the story of what's going on with them.
So in a way, we kind of all carry our stories with us. And if someone would just take the time to look, right, they would be able to observe the nuances and the way we carry ourselves, our energy.
I think there's a lot there. And then, of course, obviously listening to the patient themselves. I think that most of the time, patients tell you what's wrong with them. And it's great to have all these tests, and I rely on them. And I'm not sure that we need them all the time.
Interesting. Do you mostly work with women?
Not anymore. Now I see both men and women, at a clinic here in Los Angeles. But for years, I worked in a women's health clinic, and that is what actually prompted me to go into medicine, was a desire to be a women's health doctor. So I trained in internal medicine with a focus, especially in women's health.
Interesting. Are there any key preventative measures that women can take to safeguard their health? As you said, we often put ourselves last, and I'm assuming you've seen maybe some chronic issues that keep coming up with women.
What I find so stunning is the following statistic, that 75% of chronic disease is lifestyle driven. And on the one hand, that's just this big daunting number, and you think, oh my goodness. But on the other hand, that gives us a lot of control. And when you're a busy mom, woman, when you're busy, I love the idea of having some control, meaning it's nutrition. Did you eat breakfast this morning? What'd you eat? It's exercise. Are you going to move today, even if it's just to go up and down the steps or park further at the parking lot or not take the elevator, walk your day? The little things add up. How are you managing your stress? For me, it's making challah. For somebody else, it's actually going to a meditation class or a yoga class or just remembering to breathe. It's how much sleep did we get? Did we actually, get the recommended amount of sleep? Because it really, really, really matters. So on the one hand, it's a lot of lifestyle stuff. And then, of course, it's a lot of the tried and true, more traditional women's health topics, that things like getting pap smears, getting mammograms, getting colonoscopies, getting bone mineral densities for osteoporosis as we get older. So there certainly are a whole host of things that we need to be mindful of.
Yes. And for some of us, it really is hard to slow down and take care of ourselves. And we kind of see the warning signs. You'll understand this more than I will, but I done some blood work and they saw that my ANA levels were a little elevated. They're like, okay, that it's just subtle marker, but just, watch what's going on, slow down a little bit. You do have a gluten sensitivity, start to be more aware. And it took me a really long time to learn how to slow down.
Well, it's
a lot harder. Yes.
Yeah. It's very, very difficult. And there's a lot to be said for sort of running on that hamster wheel. I rather liked being that busy, but it came at a price. And ultimately I needed to stop.
Follow. Do you think that sometimes we run on that hamster wheel to avoid other issues in our life? Like if we are so crazy busy, we can avoid.
Yeah. It's easy. It's easy to do what you know and to just keep doing it. And we get a lot of external validation for that. Multitasking is definitely rewarded.
Yes.
And it's not always in our best interest, though.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. So let's go back a little bit to your experience in medical school. Or it's funny, I'd interviewed another doctor, Dr. Mimi Knoll. She's an oncologist. And she was saying that her experience, she had her children through, I think, her residency, and it was very challenging. She said she saw women of all different cultural backgrounds face the same challenges, that as a woman, it was more difficult to go through, having children or taking maternity leave. Did you have those issues, or did you find that it was more difficult as a woman?
Yes. And in fact, with that in mind, we actually did not choose to have children till the end of residency to just try and avoid some of the pitfalls I'd seen some of my fellow female residents have to deal with as they were having children during residency.
Yes.
The flip side was that meant that I was then having our kids at the beginning of establishing practice, which also came with its own challenges. But I'm not sure there's really a good time. There's never a good time.
That's what she said. Yes.
We just do it. We just do it. And it's the best thing I ever did. So I'm thrilled.
Yeah, I think it's great that there's more of, I think we're trying to change the narrative, at least about the idea that when women have children, they have a longer maternity leave. I'm from Canada, where the laws are very different. I mean, some women get up to a full year of paid maternity leave. I think in the States, we're a little behind on that. And I think that it's great that women are, you know, starting that conversation of we need more.
Right. I think it helps everybody. It helps the mom. It helps the family. It helps the baby.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So was there a challenge that you had to face when going through, medical school, your residency, starting your family? You know, that's a lot of balancing and juggling. What was that like for you?
Oh, it was hard.
Roles.
Yeah, it was really hard. We luckily had a lot of help. We moved back to Ohio, where we're both from, my husband and I, when we had our first two were babies before we had our third. And it was fantastic to have all of that parental support for us, grandparents for our kids, as we were new and young parents, because it's hard. It's, you know, babies don't come with manuals.
Sure.
It would be so nice if they did. But that, it was helpful to be around our moms and be able to have all of that support.
Yeah. I often ask guests, you know, how has motherhood changed you? And motherhood changes us in so many ways, but is there something in particular that comes to mind?
Gosh, it does change you so fundamentally.
It's all encompassing, really.
Right. I mean, I just, the minute I found out I was pregnant with our first, on a dime, I changed. And everything became about the pregnancy and then being a new mom and having a young child and all that entails. It's no longer me, myself, and I.
Sure.
It's the other.
Do you feel it gave you some extra sense of empathy to some of your patients? Because in a way it can be very humbling. You know, when you have
right.
your own schedule, you can say I have my 8 hours of sleep and my 8 glasses of water, but
right.
then it's like life happens.
So. Yes. And it's one thing to read in a textbook
sure.
that you should do X, Y, and Z, and then to walk into the exam room and say, well, really, I recommend this. But then having just experienced whatever I've experienced with my family, you know, it's so true that it's hard to, there's that saying about how you have to walk in someone else's shoes.
Yes.
To really understand. And parenting certainly does that. And it teaches you, you're absolutely right. There's a level of empathy and a universality, as you mentioned with the other physician whom you interviewed, that realizing that people from all different cultures face some of the same issues. It is humbling, and it helps me professionally. It certainly helps me personally. It's great to be able to see that.
Yeah. This is a question that's a little off topic, but I'm fascinated by this, and we briefly touched on it. You know, there's so much more awareness for emotional health, mental health. You know, Brené Brown is pretty much a household yeah. name. How much of our physical ailments is a reflection of kind of what's going on inside?
Oh, I think it's a pretty high number. I think it's a pretty high number. And with the rising rates of anxiety and stress currently in America, I think that we're seeing all kinds of physical ailments as a result. I think that things like backaches,
yes,
and aches and pains and all kinds of, what we know that stress can cause disease, can exacerbate disease. All kinds of diseases have been implicated along those lines, which is why I get back to when I was mentioning earlier about managing chronic disease through lifestyle.
Yes.
You have to think about the food that you eat and the exercise, but you have to think about stress management, because you've got to be in a place, if you can, as healthy as you can be mentally, so that you can be well physically. And that's the problem I found myself in 10 years ago, just prior to learning how to make Colin and having this become part of my life, was that I was not in a good place trying to manage these three little kids and work. I was working at that point in the Cleveland Clinic, and it was a really demanding job, which I adored, mm-hmm. but it came at a price, and it was all too much. And I wasn't stopping to take care of myself. And luckily, I found Hala.
Yes.
Or maybe Hala found me.
Yes. So this idea essentially of when we shove down our emotions, whether it's guilt, shame, comparison, or you know, we all deal with complex emotions daily, that can really have an effect on us. And then finding some kind of outlet and some kind of way to really face them is incredibly helpful and healthy and essential, I think.
Yes. And the good news is there really are so many ways to do that. I mean, it can be meditation or yoga or some kind of mindful practice. It can be horseback riding. It can be gardening. I mean, there is not one solution
right.
for everyone. And I find that also very liberating, because I think it can be difficult if people think, oh, I can only do X to see this result. But no, actually you can do, you know, A, B, C, D, E, F, G to see that result.
Yes. Yes. So going back to the Hala movement that you have started, do you really have neighbors who come over on Friday morning?
I do. And I have friends in other cities now. And in fact, I have a gallery up on my website now of people are sending me photos from around the country, you know, from Iowa and West Virginia and Oregon and like all over the place making Hala. It's incredible. It's incredible. It's been really, really fun. And very gratifying.
That's so special. I love how you write about, through various chapters of your book, how it's okay to consume salt and eggs and wheat, because especially here in LA, we have so many phobias around food.
Oh my goodness, yes. But you'd asked me for a favorite quote ahead of time, and it speaks to the point that you were talking about now. So I will tell you now. My favorite quote is, "Perfect is the enemy of the good." And
yes,
I really, really believe that. And in particular around food. Now, I'm obsessed with this idea of food as medicine, and the food, what we eat can really, really, really impact our health. And I believe that personally, I believe it professionally. That's my thing. With that said, we can drive ourselves absolutely crazy. And you're right, here in LA, it is at an all-time high about what one can eat and not eat. But I really believe that going for that perfect, it is the enemy of the good, and therefore moderation, it's okay. I don't, for example, eat a lot of carbs anymore, probably because I live in LA, but fine on Friday to eat a lot of Hala. It's once a week. It's Hala. Like, it's okay. A little sugar. It's okay. Not a lot, but a little.
Yes.
And making the bread this way helps to remind me of that. You know, I tried initially, so I made the Hala, it was great, et cetera. And then I did start to get a little bit obsessed with the ingredients and think, oh my gosh, I need to make it healthier. I need to, what am I doing feeding my kids this, you know, white flour and sugar and you know, all this stuff. Right. And I tried to tinker a little bit with the recipe. What I should have done is just Googled a healthier version of Hala, but I wanted this recipe. So I just swapped out the whole wheat, the flour, the white flour for the whole wheat. And it was absolutely awful and it didn't work. And I realized then, like, it's okay. Like, you can have some Hala on Friday nights. And I think it's actually a great lesson that I'm demonstrating to my kids without having to say it all the time. That by presenting them with this white flour Hala, God forbid, it's actually great. It's actually a really great reminder that it's okay. I do think that the quality of the food matters. And for the eggs, for example, I think it does really matter if you can to get the you know, organic, cage-free, pasture-raised, all of that. It actually matters. And it's a fun experiment to do either with yourself or with your kids or whatever, but go buy the cheapest egg you can find in the styrofoam.
Okay.
Which actually, hopefully they don't really have anymore because styrofoam, but you know, buy the cheapest egg and then go buy the equivalent of the farmer's market egg, the one that's the organic, cage free, et cetera. Crack them into glass bowls next to each other. And you really, you can just visually see the difference and appreciate the gorgeous golden saffron yolk of the organic souped up egg versus the pale anemic yellow of the cheap egg. And then you think, well, really, what do I want to put in my body? Like, I want the nutritious, I want all the nutrients from that gorgeous saffron rich yolk as opposed to the other. So I think about that. And again, making the Hala is a wonderful reminder to me on Fridays to think about the quality of the foods that we eat.
Yeah. And being thoughtful about our choices, I think are when we get so neurotic about food, we lose out on even the emotional aspects of food, the joy, yeah. The way it brings people together.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. It can be very difficult if you're so restrictive about it.
Yes. And one more aspect that you talk about in the book is the idea of, you know, that it takes patience, that something that we are not used to anymore.
No.
Hello, Amazon Prime.
I know, right?
You destroyed patience for us.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Can you explain that to customers a little bit?
You have to wait, for example, for the yeast to proof. Yeah. So I take the 2 1/4 teaspoons of yeast and I put it in the little bowl with a teaspoon of sugar and a cup of warm water. But then I have to wait.
Yeah.
I have to wait for it to bubble and froth and do its thing. And it's such a good reminder because I am so impatient and I forget. And the beautiful thing about challah, yeah, every Friday. So yes. It's not a one-off. It's not like, oh, I did it and I learned that great lesson, but then I forget. But I get to do it again the next week. And that continuity of it is so helpful.
I love that you've taken this mitzvah that some women consider a task. It's one more thing to do. And you've turned it into opportunity for prayer, connection, self-growth, reflection. It's such a beautiful way of looking at it. And I know personally I've started to look at it differently, where it's not like, okay, number 10 on my list of things to do.
No.
Have you gotten feedback from women on how they now view this particular task or mitzvah differently?
Well, to your point, they look forward to it because it's a fun, reflective time.
Yeah.
And if it's alone, that's great. But it's also fun to do with others too. So I love to make challah with other women. And some of the women I know who've read the book now get together with groups of their friends to make challah. And it's fun to reconnect that way around the kitchen counter and share stories. And you can go really deep, really quickly.
Sure. Dr. Beth, what are you most proud of when it comes to your career? Or anything that you've done for that matter? I don't want to narrow it down for you.
No, thank you.
The possibility of saying anything.
I think what I really like is that I've been able to lead a creative life in a way that is traditionally maybe not so creative, meaning that, you know, when you think about a doctor, or at least when I think about what I used to think about doctors and well, they must have majored in biology or some science and they're very straight and narrow that's not actually the way it is. And I've met many creative doctors since I had that idea about what they were, but having come at it from art history and then now having pivoted to becoming an author as well, it's fun to be able to lead a life with these twists and turns. It's fun for me personally, but I know it's also been really great for those coming behind me to see that. And
yes,
to see that you can do a lot of different things. Life, God willing, is long, and we can do a lot of fun different things. You know, much like yourself, in interior design, now have this fantastic podcast. I mean, it's fun to do different things. And what is so interesting is what that actually shows people around us about how to live a more creative life.
Yeah. Okay. So we are now down to my favorite part, which is where I get to ask you all your favorites. So I know you shared your quote before, but do you mind sharing it again? Because I love it.
Absolutely. My favorite quote, perfect is the enemy of the good.
Oh, I need to keep that in my mind at all times.
I should have it tattooed, except I'm not tattooing. But yes, I need the reminder. I think it's probably why it's my favorite quote.
Yes. I think it's Brené Brown who talks about perfectionism being a form of control, right? In a way where, yeah. So that's a great one. Do you have a favorite easy meal?
Well, I love anything in a bowl for sure.
Okay.
So I like to put protein and veggies in a bowl always work. Anything leftover are my favorite. So salmon, for example, or tofu, chicken, and then whatever, I sometimes do it from scratch, but really my favorite is to take whatever we had yesterday, if there are any leftovers, and put that in a bowl.
Love it.
That's my favorite meal.
Love it. Do you have a favorite book?
That's
or a current favorite.
I know. It's like asking me if I have a favorite child. I mean, I love to read. I read voraciously. Probably anything by Elizabeth Gilbert is pretty high up on my list.
Have you read her new book?
No, and I can't wait. I'm so excited.
I stayed up till 2 in the morning, Saturday morning, reading it. Of course, I was snappy at my kids the next day, but it was the best.
Oh, good. I can't wait. It's on my list for next month. Good.
Yeah, it's great. Favorite way to unwind?
Well, probably reading and crossword puzzles. I love the New York Times crossword puzzle.
Oh, that's a good
I have
one.
A go every day.
Favorite city?
Probably, well, I was just in London, so I'd have to rank that pretty high on the list. Probably London, maybe Paris. Yeah.
London is my favorite. I went to visit for years and my husband's like, why? The weather's terrible. I'm like, no, the city. It's about the city.
Yeah, it was dreamy and it rained the whole time and it was still perfect. Yeah.
So I'm actually curious though, because I know you moved to LA and I'm not from LA and I've lived here for about 10 years and I've slowly fallen in love with the city. Whereas initially coming from New York, I was like, oh no, this is not for me. What parts do you like about it?
I love LA. Okay. And I think what I love about it is the sense of potential and possibility that I feel living here. Now, I've lived in New York as you have, and I've lived in Ohio, and there's something about being here in LA where I feel this immense sense of possibility. And I don't know if it's because I see mountains and sometimes see the ocean. I'm sure that plays a part of it. Certainly nature is a biggie, but I love it here.
Yeah. Same here. I think people really come here to be creative in whichever way. So you really have the people come who want to make in the movie industry, but you also have artists and designers and photographers and writers. And it's a very supportive city, I find.
Yes, I would agree. And it is very creative. You're absolutely right, which I love.
There's also a certain energy here. Well, it's kind of hard to be grumpy when it's always sunny and beautiful outside for the most part.
It helps. It really helps.
Yeah.
I think I had undiagnosed seasonal affective disorder before coming here.
Yes.
Like it matters. And I didn't appreciate that at all until we came here.
Yes. As a mom of two boys, just letting them, every day they have that option of just running outside to play. And I'm thinking, oh my God, how did we do that in a New York apartment? So
not easily.
Yeah, we're very lucky. Yeah. The last question, who is your favorite girl boss or role model?
Well, I think my favorite girl boss at the moment is probably Emma Watson. Mm-hmm. I love what she's been doing lately, both her acting was always cool, but with her book, you know, she reads voraciously, she hides books all over different cities, and what she does politically to raise awareness, I think is great. I like how she uses her position to further women.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I feel like, you know, everything you've written about will definitely further our listeners on their quest for peace and, you know, just finding that inner balance that we also desperately need sometimes.
We do, and we deserve it.
Yeah, we really do. Yeah. Thank you so much, Dr. Beth. Can you tell listeners where they can find you?
Absolutely. Thank you. So I have a website, first of all, which is housecallsforwellness.com. I'm also on Facebook as Beth Ricinati, author, and I'm on Instagram at housecallsforwellness, which is the same handle as the website.
Which I love because you give the best tips on eating healthy or, you know, thinking positive thoughts. It's just a great pick-me-up when I'm feeling frazzled. I go on there and I'll get a little tip or some kind of inspiration to tone it down a notch and just...
I'm so glad because that is the goal of that particular...
Even the format, you know, because I'm coming from a design background, I love how it's just so visually clear and concise. It's great. So yes, listeners, make sure you check that out.
Thank you.
This was absolutely lovely. Listeners, go make sure to purchase Braided, A Journey of 1,000 Challahs. It's available on Amazon and you will absolutely love it. Thank you so much for listening in on our thoughtful, authentic conversation today. Stay tuned for next week's episode and make it a great one.